From the start, Ender was plagued by vertigo as he walked through the tunnels, especially the ones that girdled Eros's narrow circumference. It did not help that gravity was only half of Earth normal. The illusion of being on the verge of falling was almost complete. There was also something disturbing about the proportions of the rooms. The ceilings were too low for the width, the tunnels too narrow. It was not a comfortable place. Worst of all, though, was the number of people. Ender had no important memories of the scale of the cities of Earth. His idea of a comfortable number of people was the battle school, where he had known by sight every person who dwelt there. Here, though, 10,000 people lived within the rock. There was no crowding, despite the amount of space devoted to life support and other machinery. What bothered Ender was that he was constantly surrounded by strangers. They never let him come to know anyone. He saw the other command school students often, but since he never attended any class regularly, they remained only faces. He would attend a lecture here or there, but usually he was tutored by one teacher after another, or occasionally helped to learn a process by another student, whom he met once and never saw again. He ate alone or with Colonel Graff. His recreation was in a gym, but he rarely saw the same people in it twice. He recognized that they were isolating him again, this time not by setting the other students to hating him, but rather by giving them no opportunity to become friends. He could hardly have been close to most of them anyway. Except for Ender, the other students were all well into adolescence. So Ender withdrew into his studies and learned quickly and well. Astrogation and military history he absorbed like water. Abstract mathematics was more difficult, but whenever he was given a problem that involved patterns in space and time, he found that his intuition was more reliable than his calculation. He often saw at once a solution that he could only prove after minutes or hours of manipulating numbers. And for pleasure, there was the simulator, the most perfect video game he had ever played. Teachers and students trained him step by step in its use. At first, not knowing the awesome power of the game, he had played only at the tactical level, controlling a single fighter in continuous maneuvers to find and destroy an enemy. The computer-controlled enemy was devious and powerful, and whenever Ender tried a tactic, he found the computer using it against him within minutes. The game was a holographic display, and his fighter was represented only by a tiny light. The enemy was another light of a different color, and they danced and spun and maneuvered through a cube of space that must have been 10 meters to his side. The controls were powerful. He could rotate the display in any direction so he could watch from any angle, and he could move the center so that the duel took place nearer or farther from him. Gradually, as he became more adept at controlling the fighter's speed, direction of movement, orientation, and weapons, the game was made more complex. He might have 2 enemy ships at once. There might be obstacles, the debris of space. He began to have to worry about fuel and limited weapons. The computer began to assign him particular things to destroy or accomplish so that he had to avoid distractions and achieve an objective in order to win. When he had mastered the one-fighter game, they allowed him to step back into the 4-fighter squadron. He spoke commands to simulated pilots of 4 fighters, and instead of merely carrying out the computer's instructions, he was allowed to determine tactics himself, deciding which of several objectives was the most valuable and directing his squadron accordingly. At any time, he could take personal command of one of the fighters for a short time, and at first he did this often. When he did, however, the other 3 fighters in his squadron were soon destroyed, and as the games became harder and harder, he had to spend more and more of his time commanding the squadron. When he did, he won more and more often. By the time he had been at command school for a year, he was adept at running the simulator at any of 15 levels, from controlling an individual fighter to commanding a fleet. He had long since realized that as the battle room was to battle school, so the simulator was to command school. The classes were valuable, but the real education was the game. People dropped in from time to time to watch him play. They never spoke. Hardly anyone ever did unless they had something specific to teach him. The watchers would stay, silently watching him run through a difficult simulation and then leave just as he finished. "What are you doing?" he wanted to ask. "Judging me? Determining whether you want to trust the fleet to me?" Just remember that I didn't ask for it. He found that a great deal of what he had learned at battle school transferred to the simulator. He would routinely reorient the simulator every few minutes, rotating it so that he didn't get trapped into an up-down orientation, constantly reviewing his position from the enemy point of view. It was exhilarating at last to have such control over the battle, to be able to see every point of it. It was also frustrating to have so little control, too, for the computer-controlled fighters were only as good as the computer allowed. They took no initiative. They had no intelligence. He began to wish for his toon leaders so that he could count on some of the squadrons doing well without having his constant supervision. At the end of his first year, he was winning every battle on the simulator and played the game as if the machine were a natural part of his body. One day, eating a meal with Graf, he asked, "Is that all the simulator does?"
"Is what all?"
"The way it plays now. It's easy, and it hasn't got any harder for a while."
"Oh." Graf seemed unconcerned. But then Graf always seemed unconcerned.
The next day, everything changed. Graf went away, and in his place they gave Ender a companion. He was in the room when Ender awoke the next morning. He was an old man, sitting cross-legged on the floor. Ender looked at him expectantly, waiting for the man to speak. He said nothing. Ender got up and showered and dressed, content to let the man keep his silence if he wanted. He had long since learned that when something unusual was going on, something that was part of someone else's plan and not his own, he would find out more information by waiting than by asking. Adults almost always lost their patience before Ender did. The man still hadn't spoken when Ender was ready and went to the door to leave the room. The door didn't open. Ender turned to face the man sitting on the floor. He looked to be about 60, by far the oldest man Ender had seen on Eros. He had a day's growth of white whiskers that grizzled his face only slightly less than his close-cut hair. His face sagged a little, and his eyes were surrounded by creases and lines. He looked at Ender with an expression that bespoke only apathy. Ender turned back to the door and tried again to open it. "All right," he said, giving up. "Why's the door locked?" The old man continued to look at him blankly. "So this is a game," thought Ender. "Well, if they want me to go to class, they'll unlock the door, and if they don't, they won't. I don't care." Ender didn't like games where the rules could be anything and the objective was known to them alone, so he wouldn't play. He also refused to get angry. He went through a relaxing exercise as he leaned on the door, and soon he was calm again. The old man continued to watch him impassively. It seemed to go on for hours, Ender refusing to speak, the old man seeming to be a mindless mute. Sometimes Ender wondered if he were mentally ill, escaped from some medical ward somewhere in Eros, living out some insane fantasy here in Ender's room. But the longer it went on, with no one coming to the door, no one looking for him, the more certain he became that this was something deliberate, meant to disconcert him. Ender did not want to give the old man the victory. To pass the time, he began to do exercises. Some were impossible without the gym equipment, but others, especially from his personal defense class, he could do without any aids. The exercises moved him around the room. He was practicing lunges and kicks. One move took him near the old man, as he had come near him before, but this time the old claw shot out and seized Ender's left leg in the middle of a kick. It pulled Ender off his feet and landed him heavily on the floor. Ender leapt to his feet immediately, furious. He found the old man sitting calmly, cross-legged, not breathing heavily, as if he had never moved. Ender stood poised to fight. But the other's immobility made it impossible for Ender to attack. What, kick the old man's head off? And then explain it to Graf. "Oh, the old man kicked me and I had to get even." He went back to his exercises. The old man kept watching. Finally, tired and angry at this wasted day, a prisoner in his room, Ender went back to his bed to get his desk. As he leaned over to pick up the desk, he felt a hand jab roughly between his thighs and another hand grab his hair. In a moment, he had been turned upside down. His face and shoulders were being pressed into the floor by the old man's knee, while his back was excruciatingly bent and his legs were pinioned by the old man's arm.
Ender was helpless to use his arms. He couldn't bend his back to gain slack so he could use his legs. In less than 2 seconds, the old man had completely defeated Ender Wiggin.
"All right," Ender gasped. "You win."
The man's knee thrust painfully downward.
"Since when," asked the man, his voice soft and rasping, "do you have to tell the enemy when he has won?"